Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'm a current member of the board. You can find this on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Randall Balmer, author of Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory and Thy Kingdom Come. If you have ever wondered what the appeal of evangelicalism holds for many Americans, you're going to want to hear what Randall Balmer has to say on that subject. Evangelicalism, or conservative Protestantism, as it is often referred to, is not just a topic of intense interest for millions of secular Americans, but it's been a lifelong pursuit of Mr. Balmer himself. Clarence Balmer, Randall Balmer's father, was an evangelical minister who had great dreams and hopes for his son. And many of Randall Balmer's writings go deeply into what formed his opinions about the theological and cultural structures taught to him by his father, and they examine those forces that have alienated him from his father's world. In the new edition of his book, several of his books, Randall Balmer takes the reader for a journey into the world of conservative Christians in America and gives you a view of the evangelical subculture in 1989. This book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, was published 15 years ago and was the basis for a three-part PBS documentary. Randall Balmer is the Ann Whitney Olin Professor of American Religion at Barnard College, Columbia University, and has been teaching at Columbia since earning a PhD from Princeton in 1985. He is a specialist in religious history and has authored 10 books, including the award-winning A Perfect Babel of Confusion, Dutch Religion and English Culture in the Middle Colonies, another one of his writings. He has been a visiting professor at Rutgers, Yale, Princeton, Drew College, and Northwestern University. He also is an adjunct professor of church history at the Union Theological Seminary, and he's taught at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. His commentaries on religion in America have appeared in newspapers across the country, including the New York Newsday, the San Diego Times-Union, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Dallas Morning News, The Nation, and the New York Times. He has written and hosted three documentaries for PBS, one which earned him an Emmy nomination. Please welcome to the Commonwealth Club, Professor Randall Balmer.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein, for that nice introduction. And thank you to you for the audience for showing up on one of these crystal California afternoons that you perhaps take for granted, but I assure you a visitor from the East does not. I would like to begin this evening by reading the first paragraph of this new book, Thy Kingdom Come, An Evangelical's Lament, How the Religious Right Distorts the Faith and Threatens America, and then offer a kind of survey or an overview of some of the issues that I try to address in this book. I write as a jilted lover. The evangelical faith that nurtured me as a child and sustains me as an adult has been hijacked by right-wing zealots who have distorted the gospel of Jesus Christ, defaulted on the noble legacy of 19th century evangelical activism, and failed to appreciate the genius of the First Amendment. They appear not to have read the same New Testament that I open before me every morning at the kitchen counter. When they do quote the Bible, they wrench passages out of context and offer pinched, literalistic interpretations of the Genesis account of creation, for instance, that diminish the scriptures by robbing them of their larger meaning. My quarrel with the religious right is really twofold, as this passage suggests. First, I think the leaders of the religious right have distorted the gospel of Jesus Christ. They have taken the good news of the New Testament, something that is lovely and redemptive, and turned it into something that is ugly and punitive. By means of what I call the ruse of selective literalism, they have cherry-picked passages from the Bible and used those passages to bludgeon their political enemies. My second quarrel is that the religious right fails to appreciate the example of their own religious forebears, and mine as well. Evangelical activists who, in the antebellum period in particular, were very active working to reform society according to the norms of godliness. Evangelical activists animated the abolitionist movement, for example, working for the abolition of slavery. They were very much involved in the temperance crusade, which in the 19th century was a progressive cause. They were very much concerned about education and comprehensive education, universal education for everyone. They were also concerned about education for women and seeking the vote for women. These are evangelical causes in the 19th century, and as I survey them, it occurs to me that they invariably took the part of those on the margins of society. I find very little echo of that tradition in the actions and the agenda of the religious right at the turn of the 21st century. This book was born really on November 3rd, 2004, when I woke up after the presidential election, to use the words of a friend of mine, I woke up with a hangover and I hadn't been drinking. And after checking the Canadian Embassy website, I had to decide what I was going to do about this. Was I going to find a quiet place and lick my wounds and write esoteric books for the rest of my life? Or was I going to try to do something that might make some difference, that might try to call at least some of my co-religionists back from what I consider to be a ruinous course, ruinous for both the faith and for the future of this country? I vacillated for weeks between the two, quite honestly, trying to decide whether or not I was simply going to withdraw, or was I going to place myself out in the public arena in some way or another. I decided finally that I was going to try to do something. And the secondary question, of course, was what was I going to do? My example, what really pulled me out of my indecision about whether or not I should do something, was really my older son, who is right now a rising senior at Columbia University. But at that time, he was an underclassman. And at the weekend of the election, he boarded a bus in New York City, went to Ohio to knock on doors during the final weekend of the campaign. And I thought, if he could do that, then I could do something. I still had to figure out what it was going to be. As it happens, I had actually run for political office myself during that election season. I was my party's sacrificial lamb in an impossible race. So I lost, I assure you that that was really beside the point behind the writing of this book. You can believe me or not, but it was. And I had to, so I thought, well, perhaps I should endure the ritual humiliation of running for political office again. I decided, well, maybe that's not the best use of my time and resources. I decided instead to write this book, a critique of the religious right, from someone who considers himself to be an evangelical Christian. The first chapter of the book deals with issues surrounding sexuality and what I call the ruse of selective literalism. We all know that the religious right came into being in direct response to the Roe v. Wade decision of January 1973, handed down from the U.S. Supreme Court. At that time, the preachers who made up the core of the religious right sprung into action in order to reverse what they consider this terrible moral abomination of the legalization of abortion. They did so even at the considerable risk of alienating their constituents or their congregants, who were not terribly patient with their ministers being involved in political matters. These preachers even went so far and continue to go so far as to characterize themselves as the new abolitionists, trying to draw a moral parallel between their fight against abortion and that of the abolitionists in the early part of the 19th century working for the abolition of slavery. This is the story. The problem is it's utter fiction. I call it the abortion myth. The religious right did not get going as a political force in the early 1970s. It got going as a political force or entity in the late 1970s. The precipitating cause was not the Supreme Court Roe v. Wade decision. It was a lower court ruling called Green v. Connolly that nobody's ever heard about. But Green v. Connolly upheld the actions of the Internal Revenue Service against institutions that engaged in racial segregation. The whole story is, as quickly as I can do so without doing violence to the story itself, the Internal Revenue Service, trying to extend the provisions of the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed by Congress and signed into law by Lyndon Johnson, ruled that any institution that engaged in racial segregation was, by definition, not a charitable organization and therefore had no right to claim tax-exempt status. The problem was that many evangelical organizations, particularly in the South, not a lot, but some, notably Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, engaged systematically in racial segregation. No African American was allowed admission to Bob Jones University until 1971. Unmarried African American men were not allowed to be admitted until 1976. This is what galvanized the religious right. These ministers got together and they said, in effect, the IRS is coming after us. The IRS is invading this subculture, this evangelical subculture, which I've written about in the book that Mr. Epstein mentioned earlier, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. I remember, for example, when I was growing up within the subculture in the 50s and 60s, many presidents of local Bible colleges or Bible institutes would come through our church on a Sunday evening, typically for one reason or another, trying to recruit students. And one of the themes of their pitch was, we don't accept any federal money, so the federal government can't tell us how to run our shop, who to hire, who to fire, who to admit, who not to admit. That was taken as a point of pride. And so these evangelical preachers in the late 1970s interpreted the action of the IRS as an invasion of the integrity of their subculture. And that's why they mobilized to resist this IRS action. Just to finish out the story, what happened to that case is that it eventually went to the Supreme Court in 1983. At that time, the Reagan administration was in office. The Reagan administration argued before the Supreme Court on behalf of Bob Jones University. These are the real origins of the religious right. According to Paul Weyrich, who told me this personally, and I've confirmed this from other sources, what got the movement going after they had mobilized to resist the Green v. Connolly decision was a conference phone call among these various leaders, Weyrich and Falwell, and the cast of characters. In the course of this phone call, someone said, well, we have the makings here of a political movement. What other issues can we talk about? This is the late 1970s, by the way. What other issues can we talk about? Several people made suggestions, and according to Weyrich, the voice from on the end of one of the lines finally said, how about abortion? And that's how abortion was cobbled into the political agenda of the religious right in the late 1970s. The other issue I tried to deal with in this chapter is the whole question of issues of sexuality. As I read the Bible, particularly the New Testament, I don't find very much at all there about issues of homosexuality, certainly not abortion. We could quibble about one passage or another on that issue. It's largely absent from the pages of the Scriptures. Whereas Jesus himself and the Bible generally has a great deal to say about caring for the poor. The Bible also, in fact, has a great deal to say about divorce, and none of it good. But what happened beginning in the late 1970s as the religious right began to galvanize as a political movement is that these leaders of the religious right dropped divorce as an issue and turned their attention to first abortion, later to homosexuality as their so-called social issues or family values issues, whatever language they want to use to describe it. I think what they were doing was trying to locate some sort of sin outside of the evangelical community, which is natural enough to want to do that. But that was the reason they began to fixate on those issues. The other factor, two other factors actually, was that by the late 1970s, evangelicals were divorcing with the same rate of frequency as the rest of the population, which is still the case, and it's not a laughing matter because divorce is very serious. And I don't mean by any stretch of the imagination to suggest that evangelicals condone divorce. They don't. But all of a sudden, it's very striking. Long about 1980, denunciations of divorce almost disappear. And abortion rises up as the issue that they want to fixate upon. I think the other factor was that they chose as their political champion in 1980, as you know, Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California, who, by the way, as governor of California, you'll remember, had signed into law a bill legalizing abortion, and who was also a divorced and remarried man. Newsweek in 1976 declared that year the year of the evangelical. I happen to think that they were 4 years premature because in 1980 we had three major candidates for president, all of whom claimed to be evangelical Christians. Jimmy Carter, of course, who had run in 1976 as a born-again Christian, thereby sending every journalist in New York to his Rolodex to try to figure out what in the world that meant. John B. Anderson, who was part of the Evangelical Free Church of America, which happens to be the denomination that I was reared in, and Ronald Reagan, who also claimed to be an evangelical Christian in 1980. So the ruse of selective literalism, I think, is the way in which evangelicals approach the scriptures, cherry-picking things that seem to fit with a political agenda. The second chapter has to do with the issue of church and state and the separation of church and state. I call it, Where Have All the Baptists Gone? I happen to have been one of the expert witnesses in the Alabama Ten Commandments case when Judge Roy Moore, or Chief Justice Roy Moore at the time, installed this granite monument emblazoned with the Ten Commandments in the lobby of the Judicial Building in Montgomery, Alabama. My argument then, and continues to be today, is that the First Amendment, this notion of keeping the entities of church and state separate, is the genius of American life. And religion has flourished in this country precisely because the state has, for the most part at least, stayed out of the religion business. Once you begin to conflate the two, as Roger Williams recognized, the founder of the Baptist tradition in America, once you begin to conflate the two, then the faith, I think, is compromised. Also, people of faith lose their prophetic voice in the political arena. I think we see that today. And I want to be clear about my stand here in the book and what I'm trying to say. I do not believe that people of faith should not be involved in politics, should not make their voices heard in the political arena. I happen to think that the arena of public discourse would be impoverished if they remained silent. But when you have the faith identified so closely with a particular political ideology, or a political party, or in this case, even a specific administration, it loses its capacity for cultural and prophetic critique. In the course of writing this book, I contacted 8 religious right organizations and asked them in a very straightforward message for their organization's position on the use of torture. Now, these organizations have position papers on everything from same-sex marriage, abortion, family values, prayer in school, everything. Of my 8 queries, I received only 2 replies. Both of them defended the use of torture against those the Bush administration has designated as enemy combatants. That is morally bankrupt. It's also an example of the perils of identifying a faith with a particular political party or political ideology. The faith should stand outside of that. Roger Williams, the founder of the Baptist tradition in America, recognized that as long ago as the 1630s. Roger Williams, of course, as you know, was a Puritan minister in Massachusetts who very quickly ran afoul of the Puritan authorities and the colonies' authorities because he did not believe that church and state should be commingled as they were in 17th century Massachusetts. Williams was concerned that the garden of the church would be polluted by the wilderness of the world if there were not, in his words, a wall of separation between those two entities. The Baptist tradition began to flourish in the 18th century as a threat, as a challenge to this sort of hegemonic coalition of church and state in colonial New England. And the founding fathers, in their wisdom, codified this notion of separation into the First Amendment, which proscribes religious establishment or a state church and at the same time allows for the free exercise of religion, the best friend that religion has ever had. We Americans are incurably religious. Ever since George Gallup began asking the question after World War II, roughly 94% of us tell him that we believe in God or a supreme being. We're off the charts compared to any other Western country. To take a counterexample, in England, in Great Britain, the Church of England is the state church. Less than 3% of the population shows up on Sunday morning. We, on the other hand, are incurably religious, and it's precisely because these two entities have been kept apart throughout our history. The First Amendment set up a free market for religion in America, which has allowed, to extend the economic metaphor, which has allowed religious entrepreneurs constantly to peddle their wares before the public, keeping this marketplace vigorous and salubrious. And this is a Baptist idea. What I find so curious is that if you look through the ranks of the leaders of the religious right, people like Falwell and Pat Robertson and Roy Moore, the judge, the ex-chief justice down in Alabama, Rick Scarborough, who's kind of at the AAAL level waiting to move up, these other folks, they all claim to be Baptists. They're not Baptists any more than I'm an Orthodox Jew. They're not Baptists, because no Baptist would sit still for this attempt to eviscerate the First Amendment through prescribing prayer in schools, for example, school vouchers to religious schools, charter schools. These are all the emblazoning of the Ten Commandments in public places. Roger Williams recognized, and Baptists throughout American history until 1979, that's another story, have recognized that to do so is to trivialize the faith, because it suggests that the faith needs the imprimatur of the state in order to survive, in order to flourish. And so I think the attempt to eviscerate the First Amendment, to do away with the separation of church and state, is a ruinous course. There's even a movement among the religious right. In fact, I saw a televangelist on this past Sunday spouting these ideas as well, that the founders never intended for church and state to be separated. This comes out of Texas. You might imagine, I guess, but this comes out of Texas, a guy by the name of David Barton, and other people are parroting him on this issue. This is absolutely not true. It's absolutely not true. And I sometimes equate this with the Holocaust deniers, who simply brazenly say, no, the Holocaust never happened. I want to be careful to specify that I'm drawing no moral parallel between these two movements. But this kind of brazen assertion that the founders never intended church and state to be separate is one of the tactics being used these days by the religious right. Third chapter is related to this, at least to some degree. This is the chapter I examine issues of public education. I decided for this chapter to travel to Cleveland, Ohio, for two reasons, actually. The first is that Cleveland, Ohio, is where the Supreme Court made its decision, I think the wrong decision, in 2002, to allow the use of school vouchers for religious schools. The second reason was that my younger son, who has been admitted to Columbia University and will be a first-year student there beginning in September, decided to take a gap year and work for the AmeriCorps City Year program in Cleveland for that year. And so I wanted to go out and see him. He actually was working in the Cleveland Public Schools, so I got a chance to see him in the classroom as he did his rounds. I also got a chance to see both one of the voucher schools that is using public money to send kids to religious schools, as well as the Cleveland Public Schools themselves. It was certainly my impression, and this has been confirmed by studies of the Ohio voucher program, that the voucher program is siphoning off the better students from the public schools. I happen to think that public education is one of the foundations for democracy in America. And I'm old-fashioned about this, and I've taken some flack from some audiences on this point, and I'm willing to take more flack because I'm a pretty sturdy guy. But when common schools were devised in the early part of the 19th century, known as public schools today, they were the one place where students from different racial backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, even socioeconomic backgrounds could come together on an equal footing, learn from their differences, celebrate their similarities, and learn how to get along with one another in a measure of comity. That sounds like democracy to me. And if we give up on this noble experiment of public education in America, and this is part of the agenda of the religious right, make no mistake about it, we will be impoverished. I happen to think that the future of democracy is at stake. Now, I want to be clear. Parents have every right to send their kids anywhere they want to school or even to homeschool them. I don't have any quarrel with that on that issue. But the issue is the use of public money to support the sending of children to religious schools or even to private schools. I think public education is one of the cornerstones of democracy. At the end of this chapter, I visit a town called Purcellville, Virginia, Patrick Henry College. Some of you may have read about it in the New Yorker or the New York Times or other media outlets. Patrick Henry College represents, I think, where we're going if we continue this sort of balkanization of education, which I think is very much underway with the school choice, so-called school choice movement. Patrick Henry College was founded in the year 2000 by Michael Ferris, principally for students who had been homeschooled, most of them in evangelical households, the overwhelming majority in evangelical households. So you have these students who have gone through all of their schooling to that point, schooled, educated by their parents at home, moving from there to Patrick Henry College in Purcellville, Virginia, about 35 miles west of Washington, D.C., at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. And these students have never had a serious encounter with an idea outside of that little subculture, except those rendered in caricature form. The other element of Patrick Henry College is that Patrick Henry College aspires to train the new generation of leaders for the 21st century. Since 2002, 46 of their students have been White House interns. More students than that have served internships on Capitol Hill with members of Congress and senators who are sympathetic with Patrick Henry College and, one assumes at least, with the agenda of the religious right. Michael Ferris, the founder of the school, and until recently the president of the school, now the chancellor, told the New York Times that the thing he hears most frequently from parents is that, "I want my kid to be on the Supreme Court someday." And Ferris went on to comment to the reporter that if we get enough kids in the farm system, that's certainly going to happen. Well, I began to think about this. Here you have students who have never had any serious interaction with anyone outside of their own cohort throughout their educational years. Patrick Henry College is over 90% white. And yet these are the people who aspire to lead us, this beautifully pluralistic society that we have, through the 21st century. And I got to thinking, I wonder how many students at Patrick Henry College have read, for example, the autobiography of Malcolm X, or The Feminine Mystique, or Catcher in the Rye, or Das Kapital, and you could go through and add your own titles to those that list of titles for liberally educated individuals. I find that quite frightening. The fourth chapter, and I will think about what it is in a minute here. Oh, intelligent design. Intelligent design, I've come to believe, is, for me, the most persuasive example of evolution that I've ever come across. That is, you take the ancient Hebrew account of creation and you morph it into something called creationism and try to teach it in the public schools. The courts come along and strike it down. And then it evolves into something called scientific creationism. That, too, is struck down as religion, not science, as it certainly is. So it evolves into something called intelligent design. And that, too, has been struck down by the courts. I can't wait to see what's next in this evolutionary process. Seriously, I think what's really going on here is that the intelligent design movement, the attempt to teach intelligent design in the public schools, is part of this larger effort to undermine education, I would argue, by replacing science with theology and with faith. I want to add very quickly to be clear about this. I happen to believe in intelligent design. I happen to believe that an intelligent designer, in ways that I don't understand, was in some way involved in the creation process. But I take that, my basis for believing that are the canons of Scripture, not the canons of scientific inquiry. And the attempt to dress intelligent design as science is, in the words of the participants in the Dover, Pennsylvania trial, simply creationism in a cheap tuxedo. I think the larger issue behind the intelligent design movement is an attempt to overtake the academy. I think, arguably, the conservative movement or neoconservative movement, the Republican Religious Right Coalition, has now full control of all three branches of the federal government, or at least pretty full control of all three branches of the federal government. Much of the media, certainly talk radio, is very much in their pocket. I also think that they've made some inroads into Hollywood, into the entertainment industry with The Passion of the Christ, The Chronicles of Narnia, and so forth. And they sense, I think correctly, that the last line of defense against this conservative agenda is the academy. And if they can somehow breach the walls of that fortress, then they will have prevailed. The occasion for my writing of this chapter was a debate that I attended down at Princeton University, where I received my PhD, between Lee Silver, a molecular biologist at Princeton, and William Dembski, who is kind of the high priest of the intelligent design movement. And I write about the debate and recount some of the points in the debate. It's fascinating, as you might imagine. But I think the very fact that the discussion or debate was taking place at Princeton University represented a real victory for the intelligent design movement and, more broadly, for the religious right agenda. The final chapter is dealing with environmental matters. And I begin with this observation that isn't it curious that the people who profess to believe in an intelligent designer don't automatically line up as defenders of creation? And it seems to be rather odd. I talk about something called the Cornwall Declaration. This was a declaration that was written and signed by religious right leaders in West Cornwall, Connecticut, northwestern Connecticut, actually not far from where I live. And if you look at this Cornwall Declaration, it purports to be a statement of environmental concern and consciousness. If you look at it more carefully, however, it's exactly the opposite. It is a shameful display of callous disregard for the environment. And when I began to look a little bit further, I began to see who was sponsoring this declaration. And it was these hard right organizations, such as the Scaife Foundation out of Pittsburgh, the DeVos Family Foundation out of Michigan, of Amway fame, and other such organizations, as well as ExxonMobil and so forth. There's this whole network of anti-environmental organizations that are pushing for corporate interests against environmental and conservation interests. I end this chapter, however, with a bit of hope, in that I find that there is a growing kind of counter-movement among evangelicals on this environmental issue. Several months ago, as some of you know, 80-some evangelical leaders led by Rick Warren of Saddleback Church down in Lake Forest, California, produced a document that called attention to global warming and urged other evangelicals to be conscious of it and to try to redress this very serious environmental catastrophe that is now upon us. They did so despite the fact that the old guard religious right individuals, people like James Dobson and Charles Colson, tried very hard to quash this document. I think the fact that the document was produced is an indication that there's beginning to be a change of consciousness among some evangelicals, particularly the younger evangelicals. For this chapter, I would go up to an institute called the Asabel Institute in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan. This is a study center that is run by evangelicals for students from evangelical colleges, places like Wheaton College and Calvin College, Messiah College in Pennsylvania, and other such places. And students come here for a week at a time, a few weeks at a time, in order to study the environment from a biological perspective, but also from the perspective of ethics. There are courses in environmental ethics. And I came away very impressed with this kind of emerging consciousness on the part of a younger generation of evangelicals. And I think this augurs well for the future. I'm going to close this presentation. I look forward to your questions and your comments by reading the last few paragraphs of the conclusion to frame the argument. Since beginning my travels, I've developed an even greater suspicion of the bloviating preachers of the religious right, those who have anointed themselves shepherds of the flock and the arbiters of morality. They have led their sheep astray from the gospel of Jesus Christ to the false gospel of neoconservative ideology and into the maw of the Republican Party. And yet, my regard for the flock and my respect for the integrity of rank-and-file evangelicals is undiminished. Ultimately, it is they who must recover the scandal of the gospel and rescue us from the depredations of the religious right. I challenge my fellow believers to reclaim their birthright as evangelical Christians and examine the scriptures for themselves, absent the funhouse mirror distortions of the religious right. For those equal to the task, I suggest a form of shock therapy. Juxtapose the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-7, arguably the highest expression of Christian ethics, with the platform of the Republican Party. Would Jesus, who summoned his followers to be peacemakers and invited them to love their enemies, jump at the opportunity to deploy military forces especially at the cost of so many civilian lives? How do we reconcile reckless consumerism and tax cuts for the affluent with Jesus' warnings against storing up treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal? Is the denial of equal rights to anyone, women or Muslims or immigrants or gays, consistent with the example of the man who healed lepers and paralytics and who spent much of his time with the cultural outcasts of his day? I suspect that when Jesus asked us to love our enemies, he probably didn't mean that we should torture or kill them. I doubt that the man who expressed concern for the tiniest sparrow would approve the systematic despoiling of the environment in the interest of corporate profits. Jesus calls his followers to a higher standard. The Bible I read tells of freedom for captives and deliverance from oppression. It teaches that those who refuse to act with justice or who neglect the plight of those less fortunate have some explaining to do. But the Bible is also about good news. It promises redemption and forgiveness, a chance to start anew, and with divine help to get it right. My evangelical theology assures me that no one, not even Karl Rove or James Dobson, lies beyond the reach of redemption, and that even a people led astray can find their way home. That sounds like good news to me. Very good news indeed. Thank you.
Our thanks to Randall Balmer for his comments here today. Professor Balmer, we have a great many questions for you, so we may as well begin right now. The first question, there's actually two of them here, so I'll combine them even though they're essentially the same. One expounds on the premise here, and that is, what advice do you have for those of us who are atheists? And then to expand that question, nobody mentions the approximately 30 million Americans, and you may have a read on that statistic, if it's accurate or not. Nobody mentions the approximately 30 million Americans who are atheists, agnostics, humanists, and free thinkers. Are the religious right people really that fearful of rational thought?
Oh, boy. What should we do? Obviously vote is one thing. But I think part of the reason the religious right has been able to flourish over the last couple of decades is that good people have maintained their silence. And I put myself in that category. I, for a long time, have regarded the religious right as something akin to a nagging cough or a persistent rash. And I was just kept hoping it would go away. And finally, my wake-up call was, as I said, November 3rd, 2004. Are they afraid of rational thought? I don't think so. I think that one of the reasons the religious right has been so successful is because they control a great deal of the media, certainly the media that their constituents listen to on a regular basis. And they use that. They've heard very few countervailing arguments, which is, I think, why it's so important to mount these countervailing arguments. And I guess I'd like to think modestly that this book is an attempt to do so. But there's such a kind of totalism in their understanding of this agenda. And the book has been out just a week ago yesterday, but I've already received all sorts of protestations from people claiming that I'm not a Christian. How can I possibly call myself a Christian because I line up to the left on the political spectrum? And, you know, we can chuckle about that, but I think there's a deep-seated sense of that. And it arises from this sort of comprehensive world with no countervailing voices. Some people have asked me, you know, if there is this growing movement of dissent among evangelicals, and I think there is, you know, why hasn't it been heard until now, and why is it still a rather faint voice? And my answer is that people who would line up more or less with me, I don't want to speak for them, but I think it's fair to say people like Jim Wallis and Tony Campolo and even Rick Warren, I want to be careful not to get him into the soup here, but I think he's coming around. None of us has his own media network, and that makes it harder for us to be heard. And, you know, Pat Robertson speaks to millions of people, or millions of people hear him every day. James Dobson is a powerhouse. Hundreds of stations around the country. Just a quick anecdote, I want to move on to the next question here. But a couple of years ago, I addressed a group of Christian college presidents at places like Wheaton and Westmont and so forth. It wasn't those schools, but schools like that, at a retreat down in Arizona. And over dinner one night, somebody asked among these college presidents, what's the thing you fear most as a president? And I thought, well, vote of no confidence from the faculty would probably get your attention, or a sex scandal or something like that. No, they all agreed what they feared the most was that for one reason or another, James Dobson would take a dislike to their school, denounce it on the air. They said it would put us out of business in a heartbeat. Now that's power.
Well, I think you've answered this question, but I want to give you a chance. It's such an interesting topic about the hijacking of the Christian religion. How can Christians who identify as evangelical but do not accept the hijacking of the right reclaim their religion? You talked about that, but maybe there's something else you can say.
Well, I think we get involved. I think we have to make our voices heard. I'm a great believer in op-ed pieces, particularly in local newspapers. People need to speak out, need to articulate a different view. I think the real problem is, especially among the evangelical community, is that there is such, as I'm repeating myself, I realize, there's such a kind of unanimity, and there's such an orthodoxy that these people think has to be adhered to, that there are very few dissenting voices being heard at the moment. They need to be heard, I think.
Professor Ballmer, should the words "under God" be removed from the Pledge of Allegiance?
Oh, boy. you know, oh, geez. There's no way I can win on this one. I'm not going to answer the question fully, I think, because, as I said, there's no way I can win on the question. But it's what worries me about that is that it implies, or not implies, it infers that somehow the faith needs to be shored up by the government in some way. And as a person of faith, I happen to believe that faith flourishes much better outside of those governmental constraints. And so, you know, under God, my colleague at Columbia, Alan Brinkley, has argued, well, it's been around so long, people don't really pay any much attention to it, so let's let it stand. Well, I mean, I think there's something to that argument. But we, as people of faith, or I'll speak for myself as a person of faith, ought to worry about that argument. If it doesn't mean very much, then that should say something as well.
Well, I have a question. Does the word God, is it generic? Does it apply to Muslims, Christians, Jews? Certainly not to atheists, maybe agnostics.
Right, yeah. Garrison Keillor argues that in Lake Wobegon, everybody's God is a Lutheran God. Even for the atheists, it's the Lutheran God they don't believe in. God is a generic term, I suppose, although each group invests it with its own understanding. And I guess that's part of what worries me a little bit about it, when it's kind of trotted out in public occasions of civil religion. I think it somehow cheapens it, in my judgment. I realize people have other arguments, and, you know, I have to say that I don't think it's a huge issue. I don't lie awake at night worrying about that particular issue.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program with author and professor Randall Ballmer. Our topic this evening is the impact of the evangelical movement on U.S. politics. Well, the last question was about the words under God in our Pledge of Allegiance. Here's a much easier one. How do you feel about the right to burn the flag? And in your opinion, how do most evangelicals or conservative Christians feel about desecration of the flag?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say that most evangelicals, at least those who would align themselves with the religious right, object to the burning of the flag. Somebody did a story on this, you know, trying to chart the last time this occurred, and this was, you know, decades ago, apparently, that somebody actually did burn the flag. I guess the libertarian in me, which is, there's a strong streak of that, especially, by the way, on the abortion issue, but that's a whole other conversation. The libertarian in me says, you know, let's shy away from that. And I think one of the arguments before the Senate with this flag-burning amendment was that if the Senate took that sort of action, the flag that flies over the Capitol would be in some sense diminished because the right of free speech and free expression would have been compromised. And I guess I find that argument persuasive.
Well, let me give you a quick tip on the next question, and I'll say the words stem cell research. California recently passed a proposition and created the head of a stem cell research center here in San Francisco. What is your position on embryonic stem cell research, which is an important distinction from just general stem cell research? And does the religious right, in your opinion, have it wrong on this issue?
Well, I have to beg off a little bit because I don't know the all of the medical and the ethical issues around that topic. I guess my instinct would be to say that there seem to be some overwhelming advantages to proceeding, at least carefully along those lines, with certain ethical guidelines. The larger issue for me is the whole issue of pro-life. One of my objections to the agenda of the religious right is I think people in the religious right are insufficiently pro-life. That is, if you construct a moral case against abortion, which I think you can, now, abortion is a legal issue, I think, is another matter. I want to be careful to say that as well. But if you construct a moral issue against abortion, then it seems to me you at least have to call into question the morality of capital punishment. You have to worry a little bit about the persistence of poverty in our society and throughout the world. And I also think you all have to consider very carefully where you stand on the issue of torture. These are folks who profess to hear a fetal scream, and yet they turn a deaf ear to the very real screams of individuals who are being tortured in the name of our government. They call themselves pro-life. I don't think they're pro-life, not sufficiently for my satisfaction.
Can we switch gears just for a moment to the topic of education, which you covered quite well in your prepared remarks? First question, why do so many evangelical families favor homeschooling?
The homeschooling movement, I think, is a reaction, and a lot of this, I think, is kind of a whipped-up frenzy that they get from talk radio and so-called Christian radio. There is a perception, not entirely without foundation, that there is a kind of aggressive secularism that pervades public education. Now, I say it's not entirely without foundation, but I think it is overblown in most instances. I think part of the problems, one of the difficulties for public education is that administration in particular have been so worried about crossing this line of separation between church and state that they've neglected religion and matters of morality altogether. For example, I'm a historian, an American historian. I happen to believe, in fact, much of my career is centered around the notion that you cannot understand American history, culture, and society without understanding the role that religion has played in shaping American history, culture, and society. Now, to teach American history without due attention to Puritans. I mean, you go through the list. I mean, there are many examples. Without due attention to the role that religion has played in American society, gives a very adumbrated and distorted view of American history. And I think there is a growing recognition on the part of public school administrators that we have to talk about some of these things. Now, the question is, how do we talk about that? This is not an occasion for catechism. It's not an occasion for pushing one religious view or one set of religious convictions over another. That's the important issue. But the talking about religion and the role that religion plays in shaping American society, I think, is perfectly appropriate. That's where public schools have gone wrong, I think.
We have another question on education, an important one here. Please discuss the current status of the religious establishment at U.S. military academies.
I have no idea.
There's a reference here which I didn't read, but I'll read now, and this might trigger something, especially the Air Force Academy.
Oh, with the chaplain issue? That must be what it is. I think the issue, as I understand it, and I, to be honest, I haven't followed it all this closely. I have to say that I wrote this book from the beginning of the travel for the research through the editing in a space of 9 months while teaching full-time at Columbia and part-time at Yale. So I'm a little behind in my reading. But as I understand the issue, there are certain evangelical chaplains at the military academies, the Air Force Academy in particular, I gather, that use their position essentially to proselytize and also to denounce other religions. I do find that objectionable. I think that part of the problem, and I'm going to expand this comment to include all of the religious right, or at least most of the folks associated with the religious right, I think part of the problem is that the religious right has not observed the basic etiquette of democracy. We are citizens of this society, as well as having our own religious beliefs and convictions. And for example, as much as I would love all of my fellow citizens to be Christians or vegetarians or Democrats like me, I have no right to coerce. I can make my argument, I can even wheedle, and I can cajole in whatever forum that is available to me, including tonight, I suppose. But my right to do so presupposes my willingness to allow others to advance their views and their convictions in the arena of public discourse. That is the basic etiquette of democracy. This is how we have, as a society, have chosen to function in this pluralistic context. And when you have individuals in the public arena, and I suppose in this case, under the payroll of the taxpayers of the government, who are making exclusivistic claims, I think that goes somehow beyond the pale.
Has evangelical Christianity caught on in any other country? If so,
oh,
why?
Yes. Oh,
if
yes.
Not, why?
Yes, it has. And what I find curious about it, and the great growth segment of evangelicalism throughout the 20th century and now into the 21st century, is Pentecostalism, actually. And what I find so curious about that, and Pentecostalism in particular, is that, and I don't claim to be an expert on this, but it's my observation, and no one has yet refuted me on this observation, that everywhere outside of North America, Pentecostalism lists to the left on political matters and social matters. It's only in North America, in the United States in particular, to a lesser degree in Canada, that Pentecostalism has a religious right edge to it. In Latin America, for example, Pentecostalism is the new theology of the people. Liberation theology, I understand from people who know this, is really passé in Latin America. It's Pentecostalism, and it takes the part of those on the margins of society. It has become a new language for the people, a new theology of the people. And historically, early in the 20th century, right here in California, the Azusa Street Revival down in Los Angeles in 1906, Pentecostalism was, in fact, a very inclusive movement, racially as well as allowing women real roles of leadership within the Pentecostal movement. Only later, as the movement began to stratify into institutional forms, did it become racially stratified as well.
Well, Professor Ballmer, let me quickly combine two questions here on U.S. politics. Please comment on the role the evangelical right will play, might you think, in the upcoming national elections, 2008? And also, do you think that the religious right influenced at all the recent Supreme Court nominations or now their appointments?
Oh, and the latter question is absolutely. Sam Brownback of Kansas was credited, in fact, by John McCain for the withdrawal of the Harriet Myers nomination, for example, and replacing her with Samuel Alito. Yes, absolutely. What role will evangelicals play in the 2008 elections? I don't know. I mean, I usually beg off such questions by saying I'm a historian, not a prognosticator, which is certainly true. I think there's no reason to think that their role will be significantly diminished. I guess I'm hopeful, and one always lives in hope, that the role will be significantly diminished, or more to the point, that evangelicals themselves will begin to reconsider some of the positions that have been dictated to them by the leaders of the religious right, that they will recover a sense of what I would call the scandal of the gospel and alter their political views and their political agendas accordingly.
Well, unfortunately, Professor Ballmer, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for just one last question. This is a topic that we were discussing briefly before we started the program tonight, and I guess I would put a heading on it, comparative religions. Some scholars have compared Christian evangelism with Islamic extremism. Could you please comment?
Yeah, that's always a tough... it's always tough to do those sorts of cross-cultural parallels. People don't do it all the time because it's kind of convenient, I suppose. At Columbia, this is now many years ago, we did a faculty seminar over a couple of years studying the issue of fundamentalism. And what we came up with, there was some dissent among the faculty, but overwhelmingly what we found in comparing different forms of fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism here in the U.S., Hindu fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism, Hindu, if I didn't say that, Islamic fundamentalism, and so forth, is that the common factor seemed to be in all of these movements, attitudes toward women. And more particularly, trying somehow to control women. And I'm not enough of a comparativist to be able to say that's absolutely correct, but it seems to me from the evidence I've seen in studying these other groups over the years that this does seem to be a common denominator in a lot of these movements. And my objection on the religious right with evangelicals is that evangelicals, I think, should have been in the vanguard of the women's rights movement in the 1960s rather than trying to resist that, given their own history in the 19th century of advancing the rights of women and given also the declarations in the New Testament. Jesus was very clear about that. Jesus was a feminist, in my judgment. Paul was very, very clear. Even Paul, who has some tendencies toward chauvinism, you could argue. Even Paul said, "In Christ, there is neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, male nor female," and that's a pretty powerful declaration, I think.
Our thanks to Randall Ballmer, Columbia University professor and author of the newly published "Thy Kingdom Come" and of "Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory." We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
You're great. That was terrific.